Church friendly is our subject. We are actually going to use the worksheet that's in front of you, so we've got it right today. I gave the wrong one to David. Just some principles before we get into lifting up our eyes today. Some principles for the church friendly class, because at some points we're not necessarily directing you overtly to the book, chapter, and verse. We will certainly all throughout, but I want to remind us what lies beneath all of this. Why focus on this material? Well, I think the golden rule. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12 and Luke 6 and verse 31. As we used to teach our boys as they were growing up, you want to treat others the way that you wish to be treated. Going back to the old law in Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 34, the stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you are alien in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So a little different variation on that. He is saying to the children of Israel, as they are getting ready to conquer that land that was promised to them, you know what it's like. And so demonstrate that in your relationships. And you might remember that the Apostle Paul is writing a variety of matters. The book of 1 Corinthians seems to be, among other things, Paul's effort to answer some questions that these new Christians had. And one of the questions had to do with spiritual gifts. And in 1 Corinthians 14:25, in that particular context, he said he would fall on his face and worship God, declaring that God is certainly among you. How? By watching and seeing how you behave in all of your interactions. Matthew 5, 14 through 16. By your good works, which they shall behold, what are they going to do? Glorify God. And then Colossians 4, verse 5 says, and this is a great text on evangelism. He says that you are to conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. And then, of course, a principle that we're going to look at even today, Philippians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4. You're not to look on your own things primarily, but on the things of others. Paul says also on the things of others. And you're going to be lowly. You're going to be humble. And you're going to consider others as better than yourselves. All right, with that in mind, lift up your eyes. Did you ever go through an occasion where you or your child were overlooked? In any situation? Maybe back in school, were you ever overlooked? Maybe you were the best behaved in class and the teacher looked right past you at maybe somebody else who was just following you, and he or she was the one that got commended in front of everybody, and there you were, left ignored. You know, it's not probably intentional, it's not malicious, but it still can be very hurtful, can it? In John chapter 4, in verse 34, do you remember that there's a discussion that Jesus is having with the disciples? They're at Jacob's well. And he says, my food is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. Do you not yet say there are 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, that they are white already unto harvest. And then he says, already he who reaps is receiving wages and is gathering fruit for life eternal, so that he who sows and he who reaps may rejoice together. What's the context? When Jesus says this, anybody know? Again, it's John chapter 4, verse 34 through 36. He's at the well. Who else is also with Jesus and the disciples at the well? The woman. Now, as I was looking through this, there is something I observed that I had not seen before. What do the disciples do when they come up? All right, so they say, what are you doing? So who is their concern with? Jesus. Who is their concern apparently not with? Let me tell you something. This has happened before. And look, listen, in all of this, those who may fall into this have no malicious thought whatsoever. But I've stood in the back of the auditorium before, and I will have beside me somebody who is a visitor, somebody who's from the community, somebody who's coming for the first time, and I'll have a member, a dedicated core member, who will come up on the two of us. And you know what they'll do? They'll almost move that person out of the way. They don't. But they then look at me and they have a conversation. You know what they'll do? They'll never say a word. Maybe it's because they think they might or should know them and they don't, and it'll be awkward for them. Or maybe it's they're so fixated on what it is that they need to talk about or the task that brought them to me that they move on, but they've never looked and noticed. Now, they don't say anything to the Samaritan woman, the disciples. Now, and we appreciate perhaps why. What Jesus is doing on this occasion cuts against the grain of what's customary and what's socially acceptable. And now, this is before Christianity has been established. And the fact of, or the thought of, the gospel being for all is still a few years away. And so we can forgive them to some extent that they don't engage or acknowledge. They say nothing to her. They ask nothing about her. There's an enormous lack of curiosity that we don't want to be typical of us today. Because in Christ, the gospel being for all, we're beyond that. How many of you have heard the name of Tom Rainier? Tom Rainier is not a member of the Lord's Church, but he has done a lot of statistical studies. The first book that he wrote was Surprising Insights of the Formerly Unchurched. He did an exhaustive cross-sectional study of the country and across religious lines. His experience being that a lot of the trends that he saw one place, he would see a lot of different places. And he focuses in on those that he called 353 formerly unchurched. And he said there are different factors that lead the formerly unchurched, or to the unchurched, to be formerly unchurched and then to be churched. What do you think are some of the factors that leads one to have no interest in being a part of church who now is a part of church? What would they attribute? Say it again. Okay. All right. So as they are exposed to churches, that church did something that impressed them, that helped them to move past their desire to stay unaffiliated to become affiliated. What do you think they said were the factors? All right, friendly folks. They gave a variety of different answers. Okay, all right, religious teaching in general, maybe a lot of different things. Say it again. Feel welcome. Now, it's interesting because we're coming from this direction. He's analyzing a lot of data. He had forms. He had information that he sent out. And here are some of the things, and some of the things that we focus on, rightfully so. 117 of the 353, that's right around one-third, mentioned greeters and welcome centers. You guys think that's important? I mean, you do. It's very central to your foyer, and you do a great job. 111 mentioned organization and worship services. 102 mentioned children's facilities. Those need to be adequate. They need to be that which helps to address and facilitate the teaching experience. 161 mention nice facilities and adequate space, but 311 mention friendliness. Almost entirely, that factor had to be present for them to glob on or latch on. Much more than the facilities, or even how well the song leader is leading, or whether we start on time, is whether or not we are perceived to be friendly. It was Rainier, remember, that said that the biggest lie is that we are the friendliest church in town. George Barna, who you might recognize for his work in statistical studies with regard to religious things, I'm not endorsing the poor man that he talked to's view, but it's dumb not to listen to him and to understand that perception is reality. And I think what he is saying is not whether the teaching was right or wrong, but how polished or well-spoken the preacher was. Here's what he said. He said, I probably wouldn't know good religious teaching from bad, or a great sermon from one that breaks every rule in the preaching manual. But I sure know nice people from jerks and real people from hypocrites. I would stay at a church with lousy teaching. I think he means quality. But genuinely friendly people. People who got to know me and cared about me and respected my needs and boundaries before I would stay at a place with perfect teaching and lousy people. Now, when we think about that, there should not be another location around where somebody is going to teach more faithfully, more accurately, the Word of God. That's ground that we cannot sacrifice. We've got to stake that in the ground. But we need to listen to what the worldly, the uninitiated, the ones who need to grow, what's going to make the differences as to whether or not they sit and stay and listen to teaching that's accurate is the very thing that we're talking about. And so we've got to get our heads in the game. And that includes our eyes. So I want to just talk for what I think I have is about 14 or 15 minutes about four things. Number one, we need to look for people. That's the first principle in lifting up our eyes. We need to look for people. And I thought this was very interesting. Eagles can spot rabbits from several miles away. Did you know that? Hawks and buzzards both can see a rodent from 10 to 15,000 feet up in the air. And then owls can swivel their head 270 degrees. And even though they're much smaller than us, their eyes are as big as ours, and they have huge pupils. I read somewhere that sharks have such eyesight that they can see things 10 times dimmer than human beings are capable of seeing. And they have a radar in their brain that is able to detect even the slightest twitch of a fish's tail. And of course, snakes have in between their eyes and their nostrils an ability, a heat-seeking organ that's able to detect even the depth of their prey. And I don't even know whether or not I have my glasses on or not. It's hard for us to see things in front of us. And yet, the thing is, sometimes we don't see because we're not looking. A lot of things we don't see for that reason. For some reason, this may, and I think a lot of it centers around retraining ourselves for the few minutes before and after the services. You know, that's where the difference is made. It really is not so much what's happening once we start the announcements. We'll say some more about that in ways that we can help those who maybe don't know what's going on in the assembly. But how we find them, and I had another lesson, and David, I don't know if this is one of the ones that I was supposed to do and I forgot to do, but I have one called Helping Them Out, Meeting Needs. Here are some of the things that you can do to help before and after services. It has to do with where to park. And yet it is great to have visitors' spots marked out. It's been great. Y'all do a fantastic job with that. But those of us that are young, we can park a little further. And I'm still young. I know you can't tell. I'm in camouflage here. But you park far away and walk a little extra so those that are visiting can park in closer. And then there is also where the restrooms are. Now, that's an easy thing here. You come in the door, and you'd have to have your eyes closed to miss them. That's great. But, you know, depending on what door they come in, helping them with that. That's an important thing. Where to sit. And with where to sit, an obvious practical thing is not to crowd the seats in the back of the auditorium. Now, I have flown a lot through the years, and first class is at the front of the plane. Right? First class in the church building must be the back two rows, I think. If there are four rows in a church building, folks will jam the last three rows not to sit on that first pew. But you think about what happens when you come into a building. You don't know your way around. You don't know anything. You're getting yourself oriented. And if everybody's got those back pews sequestered, don't you just love to go into like a theater or some public place and have to parade yourself in front of everybody to go up toward the front to find a seat? And so we're trying to help folks know where to sit. If there's a full crowd, having those ushers to help them very discreetly and to see it's a matter of course that they can find a place to go. And never, ever, as we talked about yesterday, never, ever, ever, ever have a designated seat. All right? Do you think COVID's been good for that to some degree? Well, maybe not. I don't know. I may have just ventured into meddling and not preaching. What to expect when you are there? That's something you can conduct in those who lead in worship. What to expect? What's coming next? Why it's coming next? How to find out more information? We can't communicate enough, can we? We always need to be doing more. And then who everyone is. You know, that can be very helpful. And there, everybody's important, but there may be certain ones that we might point them to. They might want to know or be able to meet the preacher. And hey, how great that would be if a regular member of the church has found a visitor and then connects them with the preacher. Or with the elders. Boy, what a great teaching opportunity that is. Or the Bible class teachers. And so as we lift up our eyes and we look for people, that's what we're going to do when we find them. I don't have the time to mention it today, but James 2, 1 through 7 speaks to this principle that we need to look not just for some. And that's probably not as big a problem here in a metropolitan area, but sometimes in some smaller settings. Unfortunately, if we see this nuclear family that looks like they've got it all put together and they look great and they look like they might be an asset to the church, you know, we make sure that we flock to them, and then somebody comes in who's maybe a middle-aged person by themselves, or somebody that might be an older person, or somebody who might look a little poorer, and we don't flock to them. We need to be convicted about what James is saying in James 2, 1 through 7. Lift up your eyes and see everybody. Number two, make eye contact. Why do so many of us avoid making eye contact? Okay, fear of what? Fear of what?
Exposing themselves sometimes.
Okay, exposing themselves to what?
Uncertain circumstances.
Okay, it's the great unknown, right? I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know them. I don't know what's going to come after this. Now, believe it or not, I'm an extrovert. We had an intern program when I was out in Colorado, and the man who was the first young man that we had in that intern program, who is a wonderful gospel preacher in the Nashville area today, he was a hard worker. That's the only time in the intern program I ever had to say, look, you need to make sure you take your time off. You need to take your day off. But he was a hard worker, but he was introverted. And we sat down one time and he told me what was involved in that. He said, I don't mean to do this, but when I'm thinking about outside of that little comfortable group that I know and have already had a relationship with, when I'm going up to somebody I don't know, I think, okay, I'm going to say, hello, how are you? And they're going to say, fine. What then? You know, or he would script two or three conversations and he got himself so locked up he was afraid to engage at all. So the fear of the unknown, of how traumatic, for an introvert especially, how traumatic is this experience going to be for me in trying to reach out and to talk to them? Why else do we avoid making contact? Do you think? Okay, we think it's going to be a religious study and a Bible study just right off the bat. Let me assure you, it almost never happens that way. You're not going to go that deep that quick. No, your fear is right, but you don't typically just start a Bible study right there on the spot when you meet somebody. Typically. It'd be great if you would. And if it gets over your head, find a preacher, find an elder, find a soul winner who does that a lot and connect them. I think about the fact that this has probably changed. And the older you are, maybe this is not, you're not had the propensity that maybe somebody younger does. But because we have become so disconnected through technology and society, I think we're perpetually distracted. And we've grown unaccustomed to just what was routine before in the manner of training growing up, that you tell your children, look, you go up to somebody, you look them in the eye, you shake their hand, you talk to them, you look at them and so forth. That's not as widely practiced as it once was. So maybe we're just not conditioned to look people in the eye. You know, I walk through the airport. It used to be, and I think, again, it's not all about COVID, but I don't know if with the mask. I live in Bowling Green. We first time we went there, I was holding a meeting right before we moved there, and we went into the store, and a guy was holding, was it a pig? It was a goat. Guy was in line in the grocery store, and that sounds stereotypical. It's not always that way, but he had a goat in his hand, and perfect stranger, and we had this conversation with him. And people are much more apt, perhaps, in some of those places in more rural areas to engage you and look you in the eye and to have conversation with you. But that's something that seems to be diminishing in time. But we need to make sure that we do what we can to do our part to look at people. Dr. Adrian Furnham in Psychology Today said some things about eye contact that I think are important. Watch your distance. What happens if you get within 6 feet? Nothing to do with health. If you get within 6 feet of somebody, what happens? Well, forget the pandemic. At any time, if you get within 6 feet of somebody, what do you do? What's decorum say to you do? You're on an elevator. You get right next to somebody. Do you turn out and look at them in the eyes? That's it. You tense up and you just kind of look down and let's get through. Let's get to the eighth floor and get off of this thing and be done. We don't want to be too close to people. It's uncomfortable to look at people. Kathy and I were in Italy a few years ago, and it's not that way there. They don't mind getting right here and talking to you. It's refreshing. Again, see, y'all are thinking germs now, but we weren't thinking that at the time. The topic of conversation can determine whether or not somebody wants to make eye contact. Shame and embarrassment keeps one from of thinking on those lines. Do they look at you as cooperators or competitors? Persuaders look in the eye when they're trying to persuade. You look and make eye contact, he says, in order to get and to keep attention. You keep eye contact with people you have relationships with already. You're more apt with somebody you're comfortable with to look them in the eye. Personality. Extroverts look more and look longer. The confident, the bright, and the socially comfortable look more. Did you know females maintain eye contact better than males, statistically speaking? Physical appearance. People look less at the disabled and those deemed less attractive, and vice versa. Mental illness. The mentally ill are apt to have reduced eye contact. And then it can be a matter, as we just mentioned a moment ago, of ethnicity. His study revealed that some cultures are more prone to engage in eye contact and other cultures less so. So all of that being said, why is eye contact such a big deal? What does a lack of eye contact convey in interactions on the whole? Disinterest, dislike, boredom, being stuck up, being self-centered, being self-absorbed. You know, 26 minutes is always, I missed his 10 and I missed his 5. We're down to 3. Some suggestions really quick. Soften your eyes. Instead of a hard, cold stare, soften your eyes. Number 2, couple it with a genuine, friendly smile. Add a cheerful greeting. Resiliently overcome past negative experiences. I think a lot of us refuse to make eye contact because maybe we've had some bad experiences before, and maybe even with a person. You may have to forget that. Number 5, be expectant. Believe that the other person will warmly receive the eye contact. And of course, don't overdo it. Right? Don't keep the stare too long. That's awkward. Number 3, watch your face. Boy, the scriptures talk about that. God observed Cain's face in the very beginning. In Genesis 4:6, he said, "Why has your countenance fallen?" And you can walk through the Bible. There's a hard face in Jeremiah chapter 5 and verse 3. Job spoke of his shining face in Job 29 and verse 24. There was the shamed face of David's servants in 2 Samuel 19 and verse 5. There was the sad face in Genesis 40 and verse 7. There were the scary faces that Jeremiah faced in Jeremiah chapter 1. And so the point is, be careful of your face. I have a problem that when my face is, I don't think about it, I have a scowl. I inherited my dad's Sam the Eagle face, if you ever watch The Muppets. You know, I don't mean to, but I can look like this sometimes. That's not what's going on in my head. I need to make sure I'm intentional about my face. And the most important thing about this is that as we lift our eyes, the reason for it is that we are thinking souls. We're trying to see souls. Those that we are looking out at are going to spend their eternity somewhere. They're low-hanging fruit. They have come to us. So we need to do our very best to make sure that we see and understand the soul that's before us. David was hunkered down in a cave. And he said those famous words in Psalm 142 and verse 4. "Look to the right and see, for there is no one who regards me. There is no escape for me. No one cares for my soul. May no one who ever comes among us look around and leave saying, no one cared for my soul.